Coming up on Blue Dot, we talk to two YouTube science communicators, Inace Dawson and Nick Lucid. They traded in their metaphorical lab coats for the director's chair, and we get to enjoy the results. It's all new and all blue. Join us. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. For many young science majors, after taking hours of course and laboratory work, it dawns on them that a research career just isn't their calling. Usually, it's because they're people that are curious about a lot of things, so they don't want to be restricted to studying one thing or phenomenon for extended periods of time. YouTube has become a platform for many of them to share their love of science and take us along for the ride. We're going to talk to two YouTube science channel creators, Inace Dawson from Great Britain and Nick Lucid from the self-described University of Crazy somewhere in the U.S. Later on in the show, Nolan Ford will help me break down some of my favorite science books of 2017. But first, let's get to Inace Dawson. Her channel, Draw Curiosity, is a fun mixture of physical and biological sciences along with math, language, and psychology. She joined us from her home in the UK via Skype. Inace Dawson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
First, tell me a bit about your YouTube channel. What do you focus on?
So, Draw Curiosity, I tried to give it a name that would make it somewhat vague, because I want it to be about things that draw my curiosity or attract my attention. Science stories that I think deserve a bit more attention, but I am a biologist by trade and I also work on biomechanics, so I do have a bit of a bias towards biology and technology.
And your specific interest, as I recall, is in insect flight, is that right?
Yes. So I'm finishing a PhD researching insect flight, or specifically how different species of fly move their wings.
What are some of the most interesting flight mechanics features of insects? What are some interesting examples you could give us?
So insects are incredibly varied. There are easily over a million species that have been identified of insect. And flight is probably one of the many reasons that there are so many of them. I work on flies, which I think are the most interesting ones as far as flying insects go. Unlike other insects, they don't have four pairs of wings. They've actually lost the back pair, which have turned into a set of halteres. They behave a little bit like gyroscopes or accelerometers, and they actually allow the fly to have a really really detailed information about how they're flying. And they are able to beat their wings around 200 times per second, and they perceive time approximately 7 times slower than we do. So overall, they're just incredible flying machines.
How do we know how they perceive time?
I guess we can't necessarily know that specifically, but we do know how fast they send nerve impulses, and we also know how quickly they're able to respond to oncoming targets. And of course, because they are so tiny, the nerve impulses don't have to travel very far between sensory system, back to brain or central ganglion, and to the motor system.
Are there any applications for studying insect flight robotic type of flight, drones, things like that?
Yes. So right now, there aren't any autonomous flying drones on the same scale as an insect, as far as I know. The smallest ones are around 3 centimeters across, but when you factor in the weight and the Reynolds number, which is basically a measure of how relatively viscous the air that they fly in is, none of them come close to being like an insect. The closest we've got, there's RoboBee designed by Harvard, but they're not truly autonomous. They imitate the kinematics of a bee in flight, but then only able to fly when tethered and connected to the mains. So if we are able to understand how insects are flying, we can hopefully design really small drones that behave like insects, that can be energy efficient like them, and that can hopefully be more discreet. For instance, if we wanted to do ecological surveys, or if we just wanted to check out an area, maybe look for a specific target, such as after an earthquake or after a natural disaster, something that's small, doesn't require a lot of energy, and that doesn't get in the way of anything.
Wow, that's fascinating. How did you first get interested in science and nature, and in insects in particular?
I feel like I've always really, really enjoyed animals and nature. So as a little kid, my parents wouldn't let me have a dog or a cat at home because we didn't really have space where we lived. So I remember I used to always pull up the fake rug at the kindergarten, and underneath there'd be loads of woodlice, there'd be loads of ants and insects, and I would spend a lot of time during my breaks just observing them and thinking it was so fascinating how insects or bugs that had very similar segments looked completely different. So I'd say that's where my love for insects started, and it never really left me.
And when did you first become interested in taking your science background, your science interests, into science communication?
I think it's also something I've always wanted to do. So when I was little, I grew up, even though I'm in the UK right now, I actually grew up in Spain, and there's a designated channel in Spain called La Dos, where they play all the documentaries, and it's the designated channel where everyone goes to have a nap. And I was really interested in creating documentaries that people would actually want to watch and that people would actually want to engage in to learn more about the world. I remember I was very shy as a kid, so I only started YouTube quite recently, but I did used to write lots of notebooks. I had dreams of maybe creating an insect encyclopedia or website all about insects. And then as I went through university and started reading academic papers, I thought quite a lot of them told really interesting stories that maybe someone who hadn't studied the same as me would never even think to look at, or might not necessarily find it as interesting because it's written in academic language, but the actual story behind it is fascinating.
And when you started to do YouTube videos, what was the learning curve like that for that? Because it really does seem that making a quality science video is a lot more difficult than people might think.
I suppose you as a radio producer probably appreciate that there is quite a lot of work from the technical side and also from the actual research and content side. I had used YouTube as a platform, but not seriously or as an outreach means, for quite a long time. And I knew that I enjoyed editing, I enjoyed putting things together to tell a story and to have a somewhat of a creative side to something that can be quite informational. But it does take quite a lot of time to assemble an episode, and I did spend quite a few months diligently learning tutorials to actually learn how to use my camera properly in order to edit properly, and especially to do animations.
And yeah, the animations is the part that interests me. How difficult was it to learn about using that?
So I use a software that not many people use. There are not many tutorials out there. I feel to a degree that somewhat limits how much I'm able to do. But my strategy was always to start with something simple, and every time I made an animation, to try and add something new to it. So maybe it would just be simply building something and making some text move, or drawing an object and make it move across. And as time went on, I started to implement slightly more advanced animating techniques. So you'd have various elements that are moving together, or maybe something transforming into something else. So I think if you do it in an escalated fashion, each time you do it, it's a new challenge. You're not quite doing the same thing that you've done already, but you also get to enjoy having created something more difficult.
And what are some projects you have that you're planning for the future? Or if I could, throw immense amounts of money at you, what would be your dream project?
My dream project would be to go to either the Amazon jungle or a rainforest, such as the one in Borneo, and to produce a series about the tropics to highlight the diversity, the importance of protecting the tropics, and all of the many stories that are encompassed in the wildlife there that I don't think many people are aware of in a specific way.
Real quick, what is, do you think, one of the main misconceptions people have about insects and insect flight in particular?
The one I hear all the time, and it really baffles me, there's the so-called bumblebee paradox. So there was this guy in the 1930s. He was a zoologist and aeronautical engineer, and he applied aeronautical equations to bumblebee flight, and he claimed that bumblebees shouldn't be able to fly. It's pretty obvious that insects do fly, but it's one of the questions I get asked all of the time. How come insects fly? Aren't insects supposed to not be able to fly? And the reason why is they do a completely different thing to aeroplanes, and it would never really occur to me that you would apply something from an aeroplane that is absolutely huge scale-wise and doesn't move or flap its wings, compared to a bumblebee, which flaps its wings 150 times per second and is honestly quite tiny, several orders of magnitude smaller. So I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions that I hear day to day.
Well, Anais Dawson, we're out of time, but it was just a delight talking to you.
It's lovely meeting you too. Thank you very much for having me on.
Our next guest is Nick Lucid, and no, that's not his real name, but rather his persona as the creator of the Science Asylum on YouTube. He won the Alan Alda Center for Science Communications Flame Challenge in 2016 for his video, What is Sound? Nick joined us via Skype from an undisclosed location. Nick Lucid, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
And I'd like to start with some origins. When did you first get interested in science? When, was there a formative experience as a child or some things that happened that got you interested in science and nature?
It was definitely as a child. I mean, some of my first memories were of me being really excited about astronomy and the planets and that sort of stuff.
When you're out in the world of just regular folks, what kind of reactions do you get when you tell them you're into physics?
a mixed, I think. Sometimes I get the reaction, well, like, wait, what exactly is physics? And then I have to try and explain it, which is difficult sometimes. That's probably the most common response.
Okay, so explain to me, what's physics?
It's the quickest way I can explain it is that it's everything that isn't the other sciences. Because back in ancient Greece, basically everything was physics. And then eventually we started to sort of specialize the sciences. And so chemistry became about, you know, chemicals and atoms and molecules and things. And geology became about rocks. And physics kind of gets everything that's left over at the end.
When did you first get interested in doing science communication?
I think that would have had to have been the moment I first walked into a classroom. It was graduate school, and when you go to graduate school, you have to usually teach labs or something like that, lower level lectures, and so I ended up walking into my first lab, and I remember being really nervous because I never really liked public speaking. But I took one look at the classroom full of students, and I just relaxed, and I realized that this is what I was meant to be doing. I was meant to be sharing knowledge with people.
Let's take a short break. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nick Lucid of the Science Asylum, and then Nolan Ford and I will take a look at some of the best science reads of 2017. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with Nick Lucid. He won the Flame Challenge in 2016 for his video, What is Sound? And he's the host of The Science Asylum on YouTube. And how did you become a YouTuber? How did that get started?
That actually got started because one of the problems with getting into teaching, particularly college level teaching, is that there aren't a lot of jobs available. And so I spent many years teaching part time, and I got the impression that it wasn't really going to go anywhere. And I kind of realized that YouTube had a way to, you know, they had a revenue opportunity through ads and things like that. And so I wanted to sort of branch out of traditional teaching and see what I could do with that.
And when did you get started?
It was back in, 2013.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your, like, if someone was to go to your channel, The Science Asylum, what would be a good entry video for them to check you out?
I actually have a playlist set up right at the top of the page that says, if you're new to The Science Asylum, check out these videos. I think if I was going to recommend one in particular, it would probably be my How Far Away is the Moon?
Oh, tell me a little bit about that.
I think a lot of people underestimate how far away it is. And so I really wanted to do a video on that. And so I actually, there's a mix of things going on. I have some animations, but I also have my parents in the video because I wanted to get some non-science opinions so that I could, you know, have a place to start.
Yeah, it's really interesting because most people, you know, when they think about, like, for example, the International Space Station being in orbit, you know, that's out in space. And
right.
The concept of how much farther away the moon is pretty remote to them.
It is. It is. And I think part of it has to do with, you know, I don't think that the human mind has an easy time comprehending the vast distances that is outer space.
And it's interesting that, you know, as humans, we haven't had humans in around the moon or at the moon since 1972.
Right.
And that's one of the major reasons is it's really far away.
It's very difficult to get to. I mean, it took the Apollo astronauts days to get there, just to get there.
And one of the things I'm really interested in talking to you about is, what are some things that you're planning for the future?
I don't have any major projects planned, but what I would like to do is I would like to actually do YouTube full time. That would be amazing. And actually, you know, make enough from it to hire help, because what I want to do is make more, because right now I can only manage 2 videos per month, and I would like to make at least 4, you know, like 1 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because I don't get to talk about everything that I want to talk about. My mind goes a mile a minute, and I need to get it all out there, and I just feel like I'm going too slow.
What do you think is the ideal length for a good science communication video? Because they kind of are all over the place, from 4 minutes to 20.
Right. I think 20 for me personally is a bit too long, not just for editing time, but also for watching time. I don't tend to watch videos that are that long. I think 10 is probably the best, at least for physics.
And how much time does it take to produce a quality 10-minute video for YouTube? Because I think people don't have any idea what goes into it.
Right. For me, probably a full week's worth of work. And I usually do it on the weekends when I'm not at my other jobs. And so I end up doing a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like full work days. One weekend just planning the video and getting a script written and everything. And then I spend an entire second weekend filming and editing and animating it.
And do you have any favorite YouTube channels, communications and science, that people that you particularly admire?
Yeah, PBS Space Time. I'm really big on that channel. I get so excited when they have a video because I feel I like there are other channels I like Physics Girl is great, but I crave those details that don't get into a lot of very popular videos. And I feel like PBS Spacetime does a really great job of sort of distilling it down and making it approachable.
What do you most enjoy about your work as a science communicator on YouTube?
I think that I get to cover topics in ways that I would never be able to get to in a classroom. There are always these restrictions, you know, there's course descriptions and things that you have to stick to, and you don't have a lot of time to cover the really interesting stuff.
Well, Nick Lucid, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and look forward to seeing what you're going to come up with next on The Science Asylum on YouTube.
It's a pleasure.
Next, I'm joined by the man on the board himself, Nolan Ford, to talk about a few of the best science books I was able to read in 2017.
This is Nolan Ford on the board. For the full audio of Dave's top 10 books of the year, you can head to our website, mynspr.org. Today, we'll be discussing his top three. Well, we've made it to the top three. What's coming in at number three in your list here?
Probably the scariest book I read is called The Water Will Come by Jeff Goodell. And it's about sea level rise and the inevitability of what's going to happen. No matter what we do about climate change, we've already set in motion the warming of this planet that will cause sea level rise. And we're observing it in places now like Miami, in the east coast of the United States, and small islands in the Pacific. And he paints a picture of the future that's at times, you know, either you could take it to the point of being grim or just startling. And it's one of those things where people don't think about it, but 50 years from now, we're going to be dealing with refugees from sea level rise that's going to make, you know, the wars in Syria and places like that and the refugee problems we're having with that look just like a blip. And so that was a very sobering read, really well told. He's a writer for the Rolling Stone magazine, and just a great writer, great researcher, and good storyteller. And I highly recommend it, especially for people that are kind of skeptical about climate change. Read The Water Will Come, and then you will start to get a sense of, you know, it doesn't matter where you live, the sea level rise affecting coastal areas is going to affect the entire planet.
Well, you mentioned what sea levels will look like 50 years in the future, but our next book takes us 50 years in the past, in 1968. What can you tell us about this book?
This was my favorite book. Just personally, I love this book, 1968 by Jeffrey Kluger from Time magazine. It's the story of Apollo 8 at Christmas time, the first mission that actually left Earth orbit and went out to the moon. They orbited the moon on Christmas Eve, had this dramatic television broadcast where they read from Genesis and showed what the Earth looked like. They took the amazing Earthrise photograph that became an iconic part of the environmental movement in the 70s and kind of got the impetus behind Earth Day. The story, though, the real takeaway for me for this is the grit of those crew members, the three men, Frank Borman, William Anders, and Jim Lovell. And they're still alive. They're still the only astronauts married to their original spouses. You know, they're called the Original Wives Club. The divorce rate among the Apollo astronauts was sky high. No pun intended, but there it is. But these guys are still, and Frank Borman, when I was talking to Jeffrey on the phone one day, he's still flying spotting flights for firefighters in Montana. This guy's up in his 80s and still flying for his country and for public service. It's just an amazing story. And the thing I'd like to tell you about this one is I gave this book to some friends who were just like, yeah, yeah, not interested in the space program. I said, I don't care if you're interested, just read the book and tell me if you like it. Both of them just said this is one of the best books they ever read and were just really inspired by it. So it doesn't matter if you're interested in space flight or not. It's just an epic story and it's really well told.
And the number one book of the year,
Leonardo, you know, Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson is just an amazing book, an amazing story about probably one of the greatest geniuses of all time. You know, when you think genius, what comes to your mind when you hear the word genius? What person?
Bill Murray.
Okay. Yes, because you like comedy. So I'd agree with that. Yeah. What About Bob is definitely a true work of genius. But, you know, usually when most people hear the word genius, what picture pops in their heads?
When most people think, they probably think Einstein.
Yeah, Einstein. And I would say that after you read Leonardo da Vinci, you see the similarities and differences, because, you know, Einstein was brilliant at using his imagination to solve problems and come up with these incredible theories about how the universe works. Leonardo was just this amazingly curious person. His genius lie in his absolute unfathomable curiosity about everything. And so, you know, he only painted 20 some odd paintings because he could never finish any of the other ones because he was just such a perfectionist. But he was always going off and investigating something else, dissecting human cadavers when that was totally, you know, illegal, doing it secretly so that he could understand the structure of the muscles behind the face. And that's what gets you the great Mona Lisa and how fantastic that and realistic that painting is. His life is just, it's like a movie, and guess what? It's going to be turned into a movie. I even heard that Leonardo DiCaprio may be playing the title role, which is kind of appropriate. This is a book I'm getting for friends and family for Christmas. If you like art, you love it. If you like science, you'll love it. If you like nature, you'll love it. If you're just interested in, you know, human curiosity, you'll love it. And it's also a great history story. You know, it has run-ins with people like Machiavelli and Michelangelo. And Walter Isaacson's just a masterful storyteller. So you couple his ability with the epic story of Leonardo. It's just, it's an absolute gem and highly recommended.
Thanks again to our guests, Anace Dawson of Draw Curiosity and Nick Lucid from the Science Asylum YouTube channels. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. Check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org or subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasting groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Schloem. Our theme music was written by Matt Schiltz. Our engineer and co-producer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.